Welcome to a special spring break edition of Alpha Trader. Our guest today is Peter McNally. He's global sector lead for industrials, materials, and energy at Third Bridge. Peter, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Morning, Aaron.
Great to have you here. Thanks for being here. We are speaking on Friday morning before the holiday weekend. I hope everyone had a good holiday as you're listening to this Tuesday morning. But the news at the moment right now is OPEC's decision or agreement to gradually increase production over the next 3 months, even though they also reduced their estimate for global demand because of what's going on in Europe and their struggles with COVID. So, Peter, what is the significance of this OPEC decision for oil prices going forward?
Well, I think the most important thing to keep in mind here is the net of supply and demand, you know, and that's what you observe in the change of inventories. And despite this increase in production, you know, from OPEC, we still would expect inventories to fall through the second quarter. I mean, demand has been increasing. The pace of the demand recovery maybe has been a bit disappointing. And as you referenced, you know, there is a bit of a walk back at times on that. But inventories really have been falling for seven straight months now. And you're coming into a seasonally stronger demand period through the summer months. So I think that is the thinking behind OPEC's decision to add more oil to the market.
Now, there were some headlines about the Biden administration publicly saying they wanted OPEC to keep energy prices, quote unquote, affordable. Did that have any sway over OPEC? Should we be surprised by that? Is that a sign of the Biden administration flexing muscles or something?
I'm not sure about, you know, flexing muscles. The Saudi minister was asked about it yesterday, the conversation. But the one thing that he has been clear on is they don't talk about price. You know, right. They talk about inventory levels. They talk about supply and demand, but they don't talk about price. Now, we do, you know, see some potential for higher pump prices through the summer. Here in the U.S., the dynamics have gotten pretty interesting, you know, through the pandemic. But really, the Biden administration isn't going to have any kind of influence with OPEC.
Okay, and what is your forecast for crude prices? I mean, you know, not to be dramatic, but Brent is up 70% in the past 5 months. Obviously, up, you know, after huge dramatic decline last year, where oil at one point was trading negative for WTI, which was bizarre. But, you know, we're around $60 plus a barrel right now. Where do you see it in the next 3 to 6 months?
Well, let me say that, you know, we started talking about OPEC. OPEC used to meet every 6 months, and now they are meeting monthly because it has become such a dynamic situation. So, you know, with that, like, a lot can change here in the, you know, in the near term. I mean, the range of prices that our experts have been seeing is anything from as low as 50 if the recovery stalls, and things, you know, you could get Brent prices well into the 70s if inventories do continue to fall. A lot of this, you know, really depends on demand. Supply management has been very good over the last 9 months from OPEC. And, you know, we don't see the U.S. coming back in any meaningful way to disrupt the market in 2021. But a lot is going to depend on demand. And, you know, they're changing dynamics sort of every day. There's, you know, threat of additional lockdowns in Europe. You know, India is struggling a bit. But at the same time, we're seeing demand come back in a lot of places as well. And there's a lot of upside. So,
right. And so your point that a lot can change. Again, I'll remind listeners, we're talking on Friday morning. People are hearing this Tuesday morning. Who knows, you know, between now and then, another giant shipping container could get stuck in the Suez Canal. There could be an outbreak of hostilities in the Middle East. Who knows what could happen? But anything dramatic like that aside, where are we in terms of getting to a price point that production will start to come back online? Are we there yet? Are we close to it? Or are we still far away?
It's going to take time, actually, and price. So our view at Third Bridge is that you're going to need prices in the 60s for U.S. producers for 3 months and then another 6 months of drilling before you start to see material increases in supply. We're basically 1 month into that price level. And all of the U.S. producers basically just set their budgets, you know, confirmed by their boards in the last 2 months. So it's a little early for us to think that that is going to change so quickly. The rig count has been on the rise in the U.S. There is more drilling, but a lot of it is from smaller private producers. We are not seeing anything come out of the major producers. And one important trend to understand about U.S. oil supply is that it has gotten more concentrated over the last 2 years. And through the pandemic, several large mergers have taken place. So it's a lot depends on what ExxonMobil, Chevron, Diamondback Energy, Pioneer Natural Resources, these companies that have been involved in M&A are doing. And for now, we just don't see a whole lot of upside from U.S., you know, oil supply. There are trends, you know, outside OPEC and outside the U.S., but they kind of net out to, you know, a little bit of growth. And it's just, and those are in areas that take longer to respond, unlike shale in the U.S., which is a much shorter cycle business.
And Peter, this is Steve. I wanted to talk about product for a second, especially as we enter the heavy driving season. It's my impression that gasoline inventories are a lot tighter than crude inventories are. And is there a potential for, even if WTI crude was to stay $60, $61 a barrel, is there the potential for gasoline prices to rise a lot further?
Yeah. Well, Steve, I think you're reading my mind there. I mean, look, U.S. inventories are actually 6.5% below where they were last year, but demand still hasn't recovered. You know, we do think that ultimately will occur, that the demand, you know, comes back. But, you know, for the U.S., the complicating factor is that we've had 1.3 million barrels a day of refining capacity close over the last year. Now, that's on a base of about 18 million barrels a day. What are the implications? Well, we're going to need to import more gasoline in the United States as a result. Now, the Suez Canal situation, you know, highlights that, and most of it actually would come from Europe. But it is something that we are watching closely. You know, the U.S.'s ability to manufacture gasoline is more limited. Supplies are lower, and you know, the people who consume gasoline are now getting vaccinated. They're going back to work, taking vacations again. So this is something we are watching.
When the U.S. has a shortfall, we tend to import gasoline from Europe, is what you're saying?
Yes, that's primarily. There is a trade that goes on. I mean, Europe tends to be more dominated by diesel in terms of its fuel consumption, and the U.S. is more gasoline driven. So we export our diesel to them. The Europeans export excess gasoline, you know, to the United States, you know, in bulk wholesale stuff. When it gets to the U.S., then, you know, there are all different kinds of grades that are sold, you know, throughout the United States. But that's how the trade works. You know, the other, you know, sort of complicating factor, I think, that, you know, that's worth considering is that a lot of maintenance weren't done on the refineries that are still here in the United States because of COVID. I mean, getting a few hundred or even a couple thousand people into a refinery site to do maintenance that's got to be done every 4 to 5 years just couldn't happen, you know, for safety concerns. So there is a bit of a catch up on maintenance that needs to be done ahead of the production of summer grade gasoline production, but it is something we are watching closely.
So let's talk about what the scenario you just laid out means for investors. Obviously, the energy sector has had a huge rally in the last 6 months. How would you characterize that? Is that a dead cat bounce after, you know, some terrible performance in the preceding years and obviously a horrible 2020? Or are we at the beginning of some sort of, are people talking about a super cycle or even just regular old bull market for energy and other cyclicals?
Yeah. Well, back to the original point on taking this sort of month to month in terms of OPEC managing it, it's hard to see that far, you know, down the road, but there is this one trend that investors are focused on, and it is low carbon fuels. Yeah. And the greening of our energy consumption all around the world. And, you know, you are seeing major oil companies divert resources, you know, i.e. their capital, into investing in these things. So, you know, that is the overhang that is taking place. Yes, it's been a very good 6 months, but it's actually been a really kind of rough decade for the energy sector, despite tremendous growth in supply of both oil and natural gas. You know, really where the money has been made for investors has been in, you know, in refining and midstream pipeline companies, you know, when compared to the, you know, to the overall market. But, you know, there's not that many, you know, of these stocks that have actually outperformed the broader market, you know, over that time. So it's going to be, it's going to be wait and see. But the oil fundamentals have clearly gotten better. There is excess capacity. You know, I mean, U.S. production is well off its highs, and so is OPEC production. I think it'll be easier to get the OPEC production back online. I think it's less capital, you know, but if the price gets high enough, you will see more supply get back, you know, to the market.
Right. So I know you can't give specific advice to listeners, but if you were still on the buy side where you were for many years before going to Third Bridge, where would you be focusing your attention? You mentioned the refiners and midstream have done better, or do you see more opportunity in, with the majors? Where would you again be focusing your capital here?
You know, it is a dynamic industry, and it's all like worth watching. You know, I mean, you have even like independent producers committing to Paris climate goals and zero emissions, like, you know, Occidental, ConocoPhillips. You've got major oil companies like ExxonMobil talking about, you know, doing carbon capture and storage. You know, you've got, you know, major refineries, like let's take Valero, you know, as an example. You know, they have this large joint venture called Diamond Green Diesel that produces renewable diesel. And most of that gets sold into California. You know, there's probably half a dozen refineries in the United States that have closed from processing crude oil that are actually going to start selling renewable diesel. And it's an interesting trend to watch. And that actually is going to flow back into agriculture, which is something that we follow pretty closely. But, you know, it takes me back to, I guess, what happened, I'm thinking 12, 15 years ago around the ethanol craze, and that we increased the amount of ethanol in the gasoline pool as a cleaner alternative when President Bush said we were, you know, addicted to oil. That is maxed out, you know, sort of at this point, but there's more focused on renewable diesel. So there's a lot going on. And at the same time, there's kind of what we would talk about, the, you know, the pure alternative energy, wind, solar. It's all worth watching. The economics are changing very quickly. It reminds me a lot of just, you know, kind of the tech sector, where costs fall, the competitive dynamics change quickly, and there's a lot to keep track of.
So is there a future? It sounds like obviously there's a future, but let me rephrase that. Major oil companies, as you see, they're trying to adjust to this new world. There's the whole trend of ESG investing. And, you know, I hear some people saying that this industry is in secular decline. It doesn't sound like you see it that way.
No. I mean, if there's one thing about major oil companies that they're really good at, it's project management. But let's look at BP maybe for, you know, a few minutes here. They're going to allow their oil production to decline by 40% over the next decade. That's a million barrels a day. You know, that's like North Dakota. Is going to decline or be divested. And they are going to take some of that cash flow and invest things like charging stations, wind farms, solar, all kinds of different, you know, alternatives. You know, but at the same time, like, it's a good thing that they didn't get rid of that million barrels a day at the bottom. It's a lot of cash flow, right? You know, you can do the math of a million barrels a day times, you know, a $20 move in the oil price times whatever number of days, and you get some really big numbers that they can then use to invest in other areas or pay dividends. But there's been a lot of pressure on these companies, just, you know, not only from, you know, share prices, but, you know, the activist community has taken a stake at, you know, in ExxonMobil. And, you know, so there's a lot going on, but, you know, it's the energy system is a big one. You know, it's a lot of molecules move around the world, and these companies are really good at delivering this stuff. So I would not count them out.
Right. Yeah. Still the world's biggest industry. And I know we want to talk about agriculture with you. I know Stephen wants to ask you about that, but you mentioned the activist push at ExxonMobil. Before we started this recording, I had asked you about Biden's infrastructure plan. Obviously, there's a lot in there, but you pointed out something I hadn't heard anything about. So what is the 45Q tax credit and what was significant in the plan that caught your attention?
Well, it's something that's on the books and it is, you know, maybe I would say unique in that it actually gets bipartisan support. There's not too many of those things, you know, these days, but this is how ExxonMobil makes money and other companies that do something called carbon capture and storage, where, you know, they aggregate carbon and reinject it into the ground, you know, into, you know, a reservoir. Usually it's an empty reservoir that's been emptied of oil or natural gas. Or in some cases, like with ExxonMobil, the CO2 gets injected into an oil field to generate additional oil production at a lower cost. It is something that Exxon has talked a lot more about. It's an industry that, like Total CEO pointed out recently, is going to go from 40 million tons a year to 170 by the end of the decade, and all the oil companies are investing in it. So, you know, the Biden proposal, reading through the 27 pages or so the other day on the fact sheet, talks about expanding this. And there's a lot that can be done, you know, with this carbon, but today, it really doesn't work without these tax credits. Carbon prices are on the rise, which will help, you know, this too. But this is something we are watching pretty closely.
And we're speaking with Peter McNally, Global Sector Lead for Industrials, Material, and Energy at Third Bridge. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader.
Okay, welcome back to Alpha Trader. We're here with Peter McNally, Global Sector Lead for Industrials, Materials, and Energy at Third Bridge. Peter, I wanted to pivot to the grains. We had a big report from the Agriculture Department this week showing expected plantings for the upcoming season far lower than expected. Beans, corn, wheat were all limit up on top of already big rallies. They gave back a lot of those gains by the end of the week, buy the rumor, sell the news kind of thing. What's your outlook for the grains, and are even higher prices or will the plantings eventually rise to meet demand?
Well, you know, Stephen, thanks for pointing out the planting intentions report, you know, from this week. Yeah, it was a little bit disappointing relative to expectations. Now, more acres are being planted directionally, you know, than they were last year, but it's been a rough few years on the farmer with the trade wars, you know, with China, that hampered the growth, particularly in soy exports, you know, to Asia. I think that given that this recovery really has only occurred in the last 6 months, there is still some caution, you know, on the part of farmers. But at the same time, something we've been following is the replacement trend in farm equipment. And, you know, the fleet of tractors and combines in the field has actually gotten pretty old, you know, maybe as old as it's ever been. And the last cycle was synchronous with the spike in prices that we saw in 2013. And sales of that equipment has not recovered, you know, this time. So we do see farmers with a bit more money in their pocket, but in the near term, it seems like they're spending more on equipment than planting additional corn and soy at this point.
Kind of the bellwether for what you just said, I guess you could be considered Deere and Company, which is tripled from the March bottom last year and is trading at about a 52-week high. To me, it's kind of a symbol of the rotation we've seen in the broader market away from kind of the stay-at-home names and the mega-cap tech names, all of which are well below 52-week highs, while we have the oil sector and companies like Deere trading at or continually making new 52-week highs.
Yep. Well, you know, and don't be, you know, fooled. You know, there's a lot of technology that goes into Deere equipment these days. You know, it's not just, you know, some guy on a green piece of equipment rolling across a field. There's a lot in terms of precision planting. And what we've seen, that, you know, the trend has been that the equipment's actually getting smaller but more efficient. So there's less equipment that's like required to manage these large farms, but it's certainly helping farmers get more done. So that is something that you should be aware of.
Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, Peter, is Deere a space company? Kathy Wizark, you know, their space back has deer in it. I like, I got a lot of people's attention. Do you see an opportunity for them in space?
Well, they do use satellites, I guess, to, you know, help understand what is being planted where and ultimately what, you know, yield in the field is. But as far as, you know, planting things in, you know, in the moon or something like that, I'm not sure I'm going to see that in my lifetime.
Yeah, maybe not our lifetimes either. So yeah,
we had an interesting discussion on the news team here at Seeking Alpha just yesterday, actually, like kind of trying to figure out exactly what's a tech company, what's a financial services company. And we kind of said that, you know, speaking of deer, and we kind of said the same thing, like, what is it, a tech company these days?
Yeah. I mean,
it's just, right. It is what it is. Dollar General, deer, whatever, you know, yeah. Ultimately they're tech companies.
Yeah. Now look, it ultimately makes a difference in your business and what you can deliver to your customer. Really drive market share. And that's been, you know, one of the exciting things for Deere is that they have figured out a way to use technology and actually sell farmers like less equipment, but at higher value.
Right. And Peter, Stephen, you remind me, John Markman, when he was here a few weeks ago, talked about some of the oil services companies. I believe he mentioned Halliburton and Baker Hughes as being really in the avant-garde of becoming technology companies as opposed to what we think of when we think of oil services companies. And I wanted to ask Peter about the point you were making, Stephen. Obviously, it's been obvious, you know, the rotation that's happened into cyclical stocks and value stocks. For someone like you, Peter, do you feel like the world is coming back to you? Because I can imagine it's probably been pretty lonely for the last, you know, 5+ years when, quote unquote, the only thing that mattered were mega cap tech stocks.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these things happen, but like there's a lot of restructuring that has gone on. It is a dynamic industry. You know, you have to follow bankruptcies, you know, across all of these sectors. And you know, companies, they don't necessarily liquidate, right? You know, they do come back. So, and, you know, in the case of some of these companies, you know, they're 100 years old or, you know, even longer, and they've been through a lot of cycles. This past one, particularly in oil, was, by most accounts, you know, was the most brutal one, at least since the one in the mid 80s. But those that have survived, you know, are finding new ways to help customers. So,
right. So I asked you this or referenced it earlier. Like, do you think that we're at the beginning of some sort of multi-year bull market for cyclical stocks broadly?
Well, the fundamentals certainly are there. You know, there has been a period of underinvestment and demand is, you know, is rising. We've seen, you know, more concentration, I think, in terms of supply in a lot of these areas, which creates, you know, a bit more discipline. Like, you know, I referenced earlier about U.S. oil. You know, there was something like 10,000 oil producers in the United States compared to one in Saudi Arabia. Yeah, producing roughly the same amount of oil, depending on when you want to measure it. But we've seen Exxon, Chevron, Oxy, all these companies get bigger in North America, and it's created a different dynamic. And similar stories can be told in copper and iron ore and steel. So there's a lot, you know, again, there's a lot to watch. And, you know, we've seen commodity prices respond in a lot of areas. So investment does need to take place, and that is flowing downstream into, you know, as you pointed out, like some oil field services companies or mining equipment companies. But like, this thing will take time to catch up, but we are in the midst of a, you know, of a cycle that was hard to see 12 months ago.
Right. And we appreciate your time here on a holiday where, again, we're talking on Friday. U.S. equity markets are closed today as we're talking, but and your coverage area is very broad. Obviously, these are huge industries, but you'd mentioned, talking about mining, reminding me you'd mentioned in our notes beforehand, talking about rare earth and battery materials, which is obviously a hot sector for a lot of folks who are interested in electronic vehicles and other green energies. What is your take on that sector? Any particular names or areas of focus you have there?
Well, Aaron, let me tell you, everything I do is price times volume. Okay. It's just the units change, whether we're talking barrels, cubic feet, tons, ounces. That's how we like it. Bushels of corn. That's how we like to think about it. So, you know, with that, yeah, the rare earths issue, you know, is one of these things that, again, is cyclical and is making a comeback. The U.S., you know, or North America, let's say, does have these things that are required for different technology applications. But the problem is processing. And almost all of the world's processing of rare earths is in China. We have different environmental standards here. The government is backing some projects, but a lot more investment is going to be, you know, be required to do this stuff here in North America. But, you know, investors do, you know, usually have memories on these things. And, you know, Moly Corp went bankrupt and, you know, there is a reincarnation of some of these assets and people are going to try and make it work again. You know, but we'll see. That's the rare earths thing. And then, you know, we have battery materials and things like lithium, cobalt, nickel, where there really is poised to be spectacular growth. And sort of where things changed, I think, is when Tesla actually started delivering cars, right? This was the big question, like, could they actually manufacture, you know, this stuff? And now every automaker on earth is really pursuing electrification. And that is going to create more demand for copper, you know, not just things like copper, but more of these niche things like lithium and cobalt and, you know, those sorts of materials. So it's something like we're watching closely. Electric cars have, you know, been around, but maybe not quite, you know, in the scale. So if Volkswagen really does happen.
Right. I wasn't sure if that was an April Fool's joke or not, but I think it's actually real that they are going to rebrand themselves as Volkswagen. And just to be clear, do you cover the Teslas of the world, Neo, at all, or no?
My colleagues do. Okay. My team does that. That's more of a consumer thing. We do work on commercial vehicles, actually. You know, if you're selling to a consumer, that tends to be out of our world. If you're selling to a company or a trucking, you know, truckers or things like that.
The wholesale business,
that's kind of where we draw the line.
And Peter, before we let you go, we did have this week released by the Biden administration a multi-trillion-dollar, multi-pronged infrastructure proposal. Tons of moving parts in it, I know, and it still has to go through Congress. And, you know, so we're early on. But at your first take, is there any clear winners, any clear losers from this plan, or any clear themes from this plan?
Well, the way we like to think about it, you know, was were there trends in place before that can be accelerated by some kind of government support? And the two things maybe that stood out were roads and electric power. You know, on the roads, you know, I saw that the proposal pointed out that, you know, 20% of the roads need work. And, you know, they're talking about spending $621 billion, you know, of this multi-trillion dollar investment, you know, in that. And that is something that really kind of got our attention. We don't think that 2021 is necessarily going to be a big year for asphalt, because that business breaks down roughly as like 65% government and 35% private. But it is something that you should be watching through this year and into next, that if this money does get, you know, deployed, and back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, refining capacity closed, there's just, you know, there's less production of asphalt out there in the United States. And it is something that we are watching. On electric power, I mean, look, we saw what happened in Texas just a few, you know, weeks ago, and that there isn't a whole lot of spare capacity in certain areas. So look, utilities have been investing, you know, their own capital in this stuff. But if the Biden administration can, you know, create an environment for even, you know, more investment and more alternative energy, that is something that is worth noting. And then we would throw in there, it does seem pretty favorable for nuclear power, right? It is a controversial, you know, thing. And what happened with Southern Company down in Georgia and their project, but it's undeniable that it is low carbon. It's high cost, but low carbon. Once it gets up and running, you know, nuclear power isn't going to, you know, harm the environment if run safely.
Right. And I know this is a loaded question, but so just a few months into the new Biden administration, how do you see them vis-a-vis energy here in the U.S.? Obviously, there's a lot of rhetoric about that during the campaign, and that's what campaigns are about. Is the Biden administration anti-energy, pro-nuclear, pro-green? How would you describe their approach so far?
Well, you know, I love loaded questions. We deal with them all the time. But and, you know, think back, like the Obama administration saw oil production in this country double.
Right.
And I think it was part of it was timing, and part of it was they, you know, that they stood out of the way. But for, you know, for energy producers, I'm talking like, you know, oil and gas, there are some, you know, kind of concerns. And we actually think that Texas comes out as a winner, you know, in all this just because of geography. You know, I think it was Jimmy Buffett said, without geography, you're nowhere. Texas, you know, the lands are private or state run lands. They tend not to be federal lands where oil and gas is produced, and it can be exported to the Gulf Coast. Where things get complicated is if you produce on federal lands and then you have to cross a state border. And when either of those things are true, you are dealing with the federal government. And this moratorium on permitting is, you know, is a bit concerning. So, you know, New Mexico is the third largest state for, you know, for oil production. It's right next door to Texas. But if you want to transport that to a refinery on the Gulf Coast, it has to cross a state border, and that is regulated by FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And even last year, you know, there was this issue with this Dakota Access Pipeline where a judge shut it down. And this is something that got rammed through in the Trump administration. And you had the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that Duke and Dominion were going to invest in, and they canceled it because the costs were getting out of control and environmental concerns. So it's going to be really hard to transport oil and gas to markets across state lines. You're going to see less investments, we think, in those pipelines. And that's where we think actually Texas ends up being a winner in all this, because they control their destiny. You know, they produce it, they refine it, they transport it, they export it. So that's something that we that our experts have pointed to.
Well, that's really interesting, because I guess it wouldn't be our podcast if we didn't mention Warren Buffett at least once. You know, he just made another huge investment in pipelines. His horizon is forever. But yeah. It sounds like that maybe is not going to be such a great business.
We think incumbent pipelines are in a better position. If you're dependent on new pipelines, that's going to be more complicated. And if they're pipelines that were done the right way, you know, I think there've been some issues on this Dakota Access Pipeline in terms of how they went about getting the approvals and things like that. So another judge is taking a look at that whole process. And, you know, at one point it was going to shut down the pipeline and create, you know, disruptions, you know, out of the Bakken shale. But if done right, the existing pipelines like can work. And then, you know, maybe at some point we should talk about hydrogen, you know, in the future, but you can use natural gas pipelines to transport hydrogen, which is another area that's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of capital, a lot of SPAC investments. So Buffett could be looking at that down the road. It's not, you know, it's not a given that every pipeline can be used for something like that, but you know, that's how we see it.
All right, we will have to have you back to talk about hydrogen. We also didn't get a chance to talk about airlines, but obviously covered a tremendous amount of ground here today. We really appreciate your time. Our guest has been Peter McNally, Global Sector Lead for Industrials, Materials, and Energy at Third Bridge. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, guys. Really had a lot of fun.
Thank you, Peter.